Russia accused Ukrainian forces of firing on a prison in the Donetsk region, where POWs were reportedly killed. Kyiv pushed back, saying,
Russian forces needed to hide the torture and murder of prisoners.
Plus holding those accountable when extradition treaties are absent.
The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored.
And later in the program, the story of an 80-year-old Ukrainian woman who stayed behind when Russian forces occupied her village. Today is Friday, July 29th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller.
Сьогодні ночью київським режимом
Russian Defense Ministry spokesperson Igor Konashenkov on Friday accused Ukraine of shelling a prison in separatist-held territory with U.S.-made HIMARS rockets. He said that 40 POWs were killed and 75 were wounded, including members of the Azov Regiment from Mariupol. VOA hasn't been able to independently verify the claim, but Ukrainian officials deny carrying out the missile attacks in Olenivka and are putting the blame on Russia. Anna Chernikova joins us with more.
Ukraine has already responded in a couple of ways. The first official response was from the general staff of Ukraine. They reported that they definitely denied that it was Ukraine who shelled the prison. They accuse Russian forces for shelling the prison, and they say that Russian forces needed to hide the torture and murder of prisoners. Ukrainian side also says that this kind of missile strike only possible was long-range missile, and basically international partners would know if Ukraine does it.
And Anna, I also understand that the security services of Ukraine have released some unverified audio that they say is from Russian-allied fighters in the area.
They have certain interception of the telephone conversation by the DNR soldiers. And these conversations discuss two versions of what had happened. They report that Russian Grad systems were located very close to the prison. And also they report that from what they witnessed of what happened in the prison, that they think that probably the bomb was inside the prison.
And again, that is something that VOA cannot independently verify. Russian forces have continued their attacks throughout Ukraine on Friday. And one of the cities that was hit is Mykolaiv, and there are reports of some civilian casualties there. What can you share with us?
So today in the morning, Russian forces shelled one of the districts of Mykolaiv with cluster shells. This was reported by the mayor of the city. For the moment, we know about 5 people dead and 7 people wounded. So we know that the missile hit the public transport stop, and there were quite a lot of people in there. From the first reports after the accident, Mykolaiv officials confirmed that 12 people were lying and waiting for the rescue team to arrive. So numbers could definitely change, but we will wait for the official confirmations. In addition, yesterday late in the evening, it was an additional missile strike. And this missile strike hit the private sector of Mykolaiv region next to Mykolaiv.
Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Friday that he pressed Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to accept a U.S. proposal for the release of detained Americans Brittany Griner and Paul Whelan. Blinken said that he had a frank and direct conversation with Lavrov earlier on Friday and told his counterpart that Russia must fulfill its commitments it has made as part of a deal on the export of grain from Ukraine, and that the world would not accept Russian annexation of Ukrainian territory. Lavrov crisscrossed Africa this week, seeking allies amid global anger and isolation over food shortages following Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain.
Resuming shipments of Ukrainian and Russian grain has been the number one topic at each stop of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's Africa tour this week, like this one in the Republic of Congo town of Oyo. Jean-Claude Gakoso is the Republic of Congo's foreign minister.
We are pleased to welcome Sergey Lavrov, who comes with good news, including this agreement that was signed in Turkey, sponsored by the United Nations and Turkey, which should revive the marketing of Ukrainian wheat across the Black Sea and through the Bosphorus Strait.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine on February 24th and its blockade of Ukraine's ports has massively disrupted grain shipments, trapping millions of tons of grain and causing global commodity prices to soar. The United Nations says an additional 47 million people are now facing acute hunger, with countries in Africa especially hard hit. Lavrov began his Africa tour in Egypt on Sunday, reassuring his host that their orders for Russian grain deliveries will be met, and blaming Western sanctions on Russia for the shortages. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia's bombing of Odessa on Saturday puts the Istanbul grain deal brokered by the UN last week in jeopardy. And Zelensky said Moscow always finds a way to renege on its promises. Lavrov said the Odessa strike would not impact grain deliveries. An expert tells VOA that Lavrov aims to shape the narrative on the food crisis during his visit to Egypt, Republic of Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia. Natalia Bugayova is a Russia research fellow at the Institute for the Study of War.
Russia's blockade of grain in Ukraine's ports and deliberate destruction of Ukrainian agricultural capabilities is at the center of this effort, as Russia is trying to falsely link Ukraine's grain export with sanctions against Russia and to falsely frame Ukraine as a party, as a responsible party in the global food crisis.
Another expert confirmed that Africa was struck especially hard by the disruption in grain supplies caused by the invasion. Susan Stigand is the Director of Africa Programs at the United States Institute of Peace.
Certainly, the region is feeling the impact and the implications of food insecurity. The USAID Administrator, Ambassador Samantha Power, was just out in the region and announced $1.3 billion of assistance.
Stigand told VOA that Africa depends on Russia for about 40% of its grain supplies, while about 60% of the world's uncultivated land is in Africa. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
This week, we've been bringing you a conversation between the Justice Department's Director of Human Rights Enforcement Strategy and Policy, Eli Rosenbaum, and lead prosecutor for the War Crimes Accountability Team, Kristen Levesque. The conversation is being conducted by VOA Justice Department correspondent Masood Farivar. We wrap up the week as they discuss the prospects of holding those accountable of committing war crimes in Ukraine if there's no extradition treaty with Russia.
Well, first of all, I want to say that it's enormously important that we pursue accountability for war crimes and other core international crimes, that we bring the perpetrators to justice. I can probably do no better in that regard than to point out that these are the types of crimes of which former Attorney General Robert H. Jackson spoke in his famous opening address at Nuremberg in 1945 at the trial of the major surviving leaders of the defeated Nazi regime, when he said, quote, "The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated." That same concept, I think, is encapsulated in what Mr. Jackson's successor as Attorney General, his current successor, Merrick Garland, said in Ukraine on June 21, when he declared that there must be, quote, "no hiding place for war criminals." As to the real-world prospects for bringing to justice the perpetrators of war crimes and other grave offenses, it may take time, even years in some instances, for the conditions to exist to bring those committing such crimes in Ukraine to justice. But I would submit that recent history shows that the civilized world is more committed than ever before to ending impunity for those crimes. That commitment is reflected in so many ways, including in the creation of international tribunals to adjudicate cases arising out of genocide in Rwanda, atrocities in the former Yugoslavia, Sierra Leone, Cambodia, elsewhere, by burgeoning efforts on the part of national jurisdictions such as Germany to investigate and prosecute offenders, by the ever-expanding international cooperation in investigative efforts, such as through the European Network for the Investigation and Prosecution of Genocide, Crimes Against Humanity, and War Crimes, and finally in the growing efforts of civil society organizations to document atrocity crimes and press for the punishment of those responsible for their commission. Those who might dare to even consider issuing or obeying criminal orders in the wake of Russia's unlawful invasion of Ukraine would do well to consider the example of World War II Nazi criminals. Despite the passage of so many decades, they are still being pursued into old age by authorities in Germany and elsewhere. In fact, here in the United States, my office, the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section, HRSP, we successfully prosecuted a former Nazi concentration camp guard in Tennessee just 2 years ago. Wow. And that prosecution, by the way, set a new record for the longest time span between the commission of a crime and the proof of that crime being accomplished against the defendant in a U.S. court, more than 75 years.
Wow. So, do you see a similar situation playing out in the case of Russia, where decades from today, investigators will be chasing down Russian war criminals? Is that what you're suggesting?
I don't think that effort will end as long as the perpetrators are alive. But the hope, of course, is that justice can be obtained in the most important cases much sooner than that long-term horizon. And I think there's a lesson to be learned from all of this, is that neither the passage of time, even decades, nor the flight of perpetrators to countries far from the scenes of war crimes and other atrocity crimes will offer them reliable sanctuary. There will be no reliable sanctuary for the guilty. And they will, at a bare minimum, have to spend, yes, the rest of their lives looking over their shoulders, wondering whether they have at last been identified and are about to be apprehended.
President Zelensky, as you know, has called for a Nuremberg-style tribunal to investigate war crimes committed by Russia and Ukraine. Do you think there is a need for such a body?
You know, right now, we really are currently focused on investigative efforts and using the mechanisms that are currently in place because they, in fact, currently exist. But we welcome conversations on this. In certain circumstances, international tribunals of various kinds can be effective in ensuring accountability and punishing and deterring war crimes.
Eli Rosenbaum is the Justice Department's Director of Human Rights Enforcement Strategy and Policy. Christian Levesque serves as the head prosecutor of the War Crimes Accountability Team. They were speaking to VOA Justice Department correspondent Masood Farivar. Now, in a Friday meeting at the United Nations Security Council, Albania's representative chastised Russia's practice of transferring Ukrainian citizens from filtration centers to Russia.
Let's recall that mass forcible transfer of civilians during a conflict to the territory of the occupying party is prohibited under the 1949 Geneva Conventions. It constitutes a war crime.
U.S. Envoy Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield said that Moscow's actions since February 24th have set the U.N. Charter on fire.
Russia is currently reviewing plans to attempt to annex the region of Kherson and Zaporizhia and all of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. This is galling. The acquisition of territory by force is about as clear a violation of the UN Charter as you can get. And we will not stand by and let it happen in silence.
Russia has denied involvement in war crimes and has accused Kyiv of staging them to smear its forces and said it's investigating Ukrainian war crimes. We'll have additional updates from the meeting, as well as other news from throughout the day on our website, voanews.com/flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. When Russian soldiers occupied Borodyanka outside of Kyiv in March of this year, 80-year-old Helena Derevyanko stayed in her apartment. Her neighbors had left, fleeing the airstrikes. But she remained with her adult son in a 5-story building because she had neither the strength nor the opportunity to leave the house. Anna Kostachenko brings us her story.
80-year-old Helena Derevyanko was in her apartment in Borodyanka in the Kyiv region when Russia invaded Ukraine. What she didn't know then was that she would end up staying in this apartment throughout the Russian occupation in March.
There were only two of us in the whole building when Russians broke in. They vandalized everything in the basement, and then there were two explosions, and my son's friend was blown up.
As Russian soldiers tried to break the building entrance door, Derevyanko remembered her neighbor's advice. If occupiers are trying to force the entry, they can later punish residents for not helping them. So she decided it would be better to open the door herself.
I said, "Here I am, in front of you, a gray-haired mother. Do with me what you want."
Russian soldiers didn't believe Derevyanko when she told them the whole building was empty, and they started breaking doors to all the other apartments. After they searched the building, the occupiers wrote the letter P for Proverino, or checked, on each apartment door to indicate it had been inspected. They later returned to take what they wanted from the empty apartments, Derevyanko says. The apartment owners repaired the entrance door after Borodyanka was liberated by the armed forces of Ukraine. Derevyanko's friend Valentina Myazovar also returned to the town. She had stayed at a nearby village during the occupation, hoping things would be better there.
We thought it would be safer there, but it was hell. Russians came to us one day and told us they were looking for Nazis and Poles.
After the Russians left, Myazova found her native town Borodyanka in ruins and some of her friends dead.
They shot my neighbor's son dead, and she buried him in the yard under shelling.
Residents of the apartment building show pieces of the grenades they keep finding. But many have nothing to show. Many people in Borodyanka were killed in the Russian shelling. For many, the basements of their own homes became deadly traps. Anna Kostyuchenko for VOA News from Borodyanka, Ukraine.
Saving civilians of all nationalities from the most dangerous war zones in Ukraine. Well, that's the mission of the American nonprofit organization Project Dynamo. The group recently rescued an American who was held captive by Russian troops. VOA's Maria Prue spoke with one of the group's founders, Brian Stern.
This footage shows the rescue mission of Michigan native Kirill Alexandrov, his wife and mother-in-law. Kirill had been held captive by Russian forces in the southern Ukrainian region of Kherson for more than a month.
The second I was arrested by the Russian military, they came into my home while I was showering. They beat me. They beat me while I was cuffed. They violently assaulted my wife. They took me in. Performed a mock execution, beat me more, and I was stuck in a cell for 36, 37 days.
Alexandrov was falsely accused by his Russian captors of being a spy, say his rescuers in Project Dynamo.
When the Russians came, that just because he was an American citizen, he was implicated.
Now, following the tactical rescue operation conducted by Project Dynamo, Alexandrov and his family are free. Based in Florida, Project Dynamo is a privately run, donor-funded evacuation group founded by several U.S. service members to rescue Americans and their allies from Afghanistan during the 2021 U.S. withdrawal. While remaining operational in Afghanistan, Project Dynamo has been working in Ukraine since early February, says Stern, a U.S. military combat veteran.
We prioritize based off the circumstance. If you're in Mariupol, we pay, you know, if you're an arrested spy, we pay attention a little bit more. If you're, we give preferential treatment to babies and children. So there's a lot of babies that are born in Ukraine to surrogate mothers, and they're just babies. They have no way to get a passport because they're just babies and their parents aren't with them.
Stern says that in over 60 missions, their small group has managed to save over 700 people of different nationalities. With Alexandrov, Stern says they had received intelligence that he was scheduled to be extradited to Moscow, where he would have faced imprisonment for more than 20 years. Alexandrov is grateful to be rescued.
When I was released, it was the most relief I've ever felt in my life. I was extremely happy to see my family. My mother, I haven't seen her just shy of a year. My family's alive. I'm alive simply because of Brian and his team.
Russia denies targeting civilians, but Stern says Project Dynamo is now in discussions with the United Nations, the International Criminal Court, and the U.S. government regarding the abuse Alexandrov and his family suffered in Russian custody. Maria Prus, VOA News.
More than 5 months after Russia began its attack on Ukraine, there is concern the world's attention on the war is fading. To help, Ukraine's tennis and soccer stars are joining with their Polish counterparts to raise awareness and funds for Ukraine. VOA's Mirosława Gongadze rounds us out.
Spectators and television viewers watched big-name Polish and Ukrainian players battle it out at Krakow's Tauron Arena in the exhibition match to benefit Ukraine. Polish tennis star Iga Swiatek, ranked number one in the world, organized the July 23rd event to raise money for young Ukrainians affected by the war. Ukraine's top tennis player Alina Svitolina, who is pregnant, judged the match.
I feel like that's very few people and very few countries really understand the horrible thing what is happening, the horrible war that is happening in Ukraine. And for us, it's very important, this kind of events where we can speak to the people, that we can join and unite all together for the help of the people who are in need. And hopefully one day we can celebrate the win of Ukraine.
Serhiy Stachowski is a former professional tennis player from Ukraine who retired this year to join the army after the Russian invasion. He expressed concern that the world's attention on the war is fading.
We're trying to raise awareness. We're trying to build up something that will continue to talk about Ukrainian war, because the war is still on. It's a full scale and the intensity is quite high. We need any support we can get.
Former professional soccer player and the head coach of the Ukrainian national team, Andriy Shevchenko, appeared as a special guest. He is an ambassador for United 24, Ukraine's official global initiative to help restore and develop the country.
My duty, I want to help my country. I think that we just have to keep the awareness about what's going on and exactly truth, and speak loud, talk the truth to the people about this war, about Russian aggression.
Shevchenko said even though the world has responded to the war in Ukraine, more help is needed. Yaroslava Hres is a coordinator for United 24.
It's not so easy to ask people again and again to donate. So this is a new way of fundraising.
Tennis lovers indeed packed the arena, and the event raised more than $500,000 for Ukraine. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Krakow, Poland.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.